From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been a long week, from 4th of July fireworks to bloody explosions in the London Underground. The kind of week when you might reach out for a steadying hand. Post 9/11, many Americans found that kind of hand in poet rocker Bruce Springsteen.
Shirts in the closet, shoes in the hall, mama's in the kitchen, baby and all.
Since 1973, Bruce Springsteen has captured America in song, from Asbury Park to Nebraska to the absent shadow of Manhattan's Twin Towers. His music, like this track, You're Missing, from his post-9/11 album The Rising, has resonated with mainstream Americans like that of few other musicians of the rock and roll age. There are shelves full of books on the Boss, biographies, critical studies, children's books, even fiction based on the stories in his songs. Now, a wave of smart new books is diving into the Springsteen phenomenon. This hour, we'll dive in with them. Tonight on Point, new angles on the life, music, and impact of America's great and gritty rock and roll bard, Bruce Springsteen.
Pictures on the nightstand, TV's on in the den.
You can join the conversation. What is Bruce Springsteen to you? Blue-collar hero, the Boss, American everyman, or is he just too much? What's your most powerful Springsteen moment, concert, memory? What's the chord that Springsteen plays in the American heart? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Jimmy Gutterman. He's author of 5 books on rock and roll. His latest is Runaway American Dream, Listening to Bruce Springsteen. Jimmy Gutterman, it's a great book. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined in the studio tonight by Tim Riley, music critic and author of many popular books on music. His latest is Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Tim Riley, good to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks to be here.
So, we've got this terrific new raft of books. Yours right in the middle of all of them, Jimmy Gutterman, and very, very highly praised in the New York Times this last weekend. Congratulations to you on that. There's this wonderful spectrum of views of Bruce Springsteen. I mean, you take us into lots of concerts and into lots of moments in Bruce Springsteen's life in a generally deeply admiring way. Then we've got this interesting book as well by Stephen Metcalf, a kind of different take on things. He talks about the Springsteen personas having been sort of made up. He calls him at heart. What does he say? Sort of the scrawny, scruffy kid from New Jersey turned into a majestic American simpleton. These are kind of fighting words in the Springsteen arena. You start out with him very early on when you describe Bruce Springsteen as wanting to be, among many others, who are trying to be the new Dylan. Take us back to that early persona, not even a persona at that time, just a kid trying to be a musician, a well-known musician. What's the beginning look like in this life?
Well, I think he was always more than that. He wanted to have the words of Bob Dylan, but he also wanted to have the sound of Bob Dylan. He loved the sound of Dylan's records as well as the lyric sheet.
The folky sound or
the wildness of those great 65, 66 records that Tim's written about so well. The notion that you could be just as crazy in your music as you could in your lyrics. And if you listen to those first two records he made, particularly the second one, The Wild, The Innocent, and The East Street Shuffle, they're the wildest records he's ever made. The most unkempt.
And I have to say, still my favorites, after all these years, maybe that places me somehow. Mm-hmm. But you note that by the time he gets to The Boss and Born in the USA, there's a kind of different polish, a different tone. We'll come to that. Tim Riley, what's just your top level on this? I mean, he's described by every superlative you want to apply, but there's some special relationship to the American character or America's mainstream sense of itself. What is it that Bruce Springsteen taps into, captures there?
Well, what I wanted to write about with Springsteen was that I think he presents a completely different way and idea about being a man in the modern era. And this is why he is the final chapter to the book Fever that I wrote, which is all about how rock and roll presents all these new ideas about gender.
Mm-hmm.
And he really writes about it more explicitly and more extensively than most other rock and rollers. And I kind of see it as like an implicit subject in a lot of rock and roll, and he made it very explicit.
Well, but maybe in the lyrics, and I wish you'd take us into some of the poetry there. Of course, the imagery, I mean, going right back to Born in the USA, it's that T-shirt and the dungarees and the cocktip, and he's famously the rocker in cowboy boots with the metal studs, not punk style, but stud style. No ambiguity. This is no Prince on the stage.
Yeah, I think it's very ambiguous, actually. I think
in the music.
I think it gets misperceived as kind of a macho stance,
mm-hmm.
and I think it is not a macho stance. I think it's a very defiantly non-macho stance.
Remember, this is a man who spent more time on stage kissing his male saxophone player than his female wife.
This is Clarence.
Indeed.
Yeah, Bruce Springsteen on stage, not macho. I mean, I haven't seen him on stage since a concert in Tokyo in the 80s. I have to say, on that night, it came across as all macho.
So that was during the Born in the USA
period?
Yeah,
and and the shirt sleeves rolled up, and it was pointy cowboy boots, and he was no longer the skinny kid. He was buff, you know?
He was a caricature of a rock star. I mean, remember what the guy put on the cover of Born in the USA to sell himself? A tight close-up of his butt.
Mm-hmm. With the red handkerchief, as I recall.
Yeah, and this is not someone who was really, at that particular point in his career, looking to expand ideas of masculinity. He was there in the tight T-shirt and the tight jeans.
Yeah, although, I mean, I just never think it's as simple as all that. When we say that, that was the surface sort of image that people took away with Born in the USA, and it was a very canny commercial move. But he had also, by that point, he had written and released Nebraska, and there's a lot of images of manhood on Nebraska, the people who losing their jobs and feeling like they're losing their sense of self and their sense of identity, and what, you know, how can I be a man if I don't have a job? I mean, that's a theme that's really important.
They're beaten up. They're hardly large and in charge. But at the same time, they're masculine, even in their distress. Before we get to Nebraska, I want to stick with those New Jersey days.
Sure.
For a moment. I want to go all the way back to 1973. This is a song entitled Kitty's Back from The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle, 1973. It's from his second album after the 1972 debut, Greetings from Asbury Park. This is the jazzy sound you're talking about, Jimmy Guterman.
Indeed, it's a wild record. It's all these different parts that shouldn't work together. It's this part Van Morrison, part Major Lance, part Bob Dylan, part crazy.
Son of a bus driver and, what was it, his mom, a seamstress? I forget now. But, I mean, describe where he came from. It is New Jersey, and Asbury Park in particular, special.
Well, he actually grew up inland from Asbury Park in Freehold.
So migrated toward that community, a unique community on the shore. Tell us about it.
Well, in the late 60s, early 70s, it was already a faded community. There had been some riots there in the 60s, and it was a place for misfits, and it was a place for self-identified misfits, and Springsteen fell in with that group very nicely.
And the kind of seediness that is a recurring theme through his albums, plenty of that in Asbury Park.
That's a really good point, and I think that's one of the things that differentiates his earlier records from his later records. His later records are full of very earnest characters. I'm sure we'll talk about The Rising later, but there are no bad guys on the Rising except for the first verse of one song. They're all good people trying to do well. There are a lot of creeps in his early songs. Nebraska is a record full of creeps, and it might be his best record. He's good at writing about creeps.
And the Dylan, the new Dylan aspiration, as you say, not to be a copycat, but to be his own, but very much in that sense, in that groove of wanting to bring poetry, that kind of scat poetry almost of Dylan, to his rock and roll.
It was not to sound like Dylan, but to get the freedom of Dylan, to get the approach that Dylan allowed other people to have.
Another point to make on these early records, I think, is that his ambition was kind of wild, and I like Jimmy's word, unkempt.
Yes.
Know? And he had this jazz piano player, David Sanchez, and he really was stretching in all different kinds of directions and trying to find a voice. And that's what makes those records kind of wildly entertaining. And then once he establishes himself with Born to Run, he kind of backshifts into lower gear, into roots rock, and he stays in roots rock for the rest of his career, starting with Darkness on the Edge of Town. So I remember my early impressions of Bruce were, this guy is showing such great promise.
Absolutely.
For the progressive nature of rock and roll.
Right, let's
for
take it
stretching
forward.
The form.
Yeah.
And then he pared his songs way down, and they got much, much simpler. And I always thought that was a very daring move, and I think it really did pay off in the long run.
A daring move? Jimmy, you describe it as ultimate, or some do, as ultimately a very conservative move.
I think his musical conservatism, as opposed to his political views, his musical conservatism really explains his longevity. It's why more people are buying his records in his 50s and his 20s. It's why, you know, grown men stand in the rain at arenas and stadiums around the country still to hear him.
To hear Born to Run.
But the move from Wild and Innocent to Born to Run and Beyond was really the move from playing for down the block, playing for not even a regional audience, for a local audience, but for writing for a national audience.
To writing for America. We're going to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about the new wave of interpretations of Bruce Springsteen, rocker, poet, American troubadour, His Hungry Heart, from The River, 1980. I'll be right back. This is Tom Ashbrook and On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with Bruce Springsteen, Ties That Bind, The River, 1980. Talking tonight about the new wave of interpretations of Bruce Springsteen, rocker, poet, American troubadour. My guest tonight, Jimmy Gutterman. His new book is Runaway American Dream, Listening to Bruce Springsteen, and it's a wonderful book. Tim Riley is with us as well, music critic, author of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Tim, we've talked about that, a terrific book as well. You can join this conversation. What is Bruce Springsteen to you? Every man, working class hero, the boss, too much. Are you a fan? What's he meant to you? Are you a skeptic? Why? And when things are blowing up, 9/11 towers, subways in London, do you turn to Springsteen? Does he somehow center your American-ness? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined right now from New York by Jim Cullen. His new book is Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen and the American Tradition. Jim Cullen, thanks for being with us tonight.
Glad to join the conversation.
Jim, you put Bruce Springsteen in the kind of American spectrum of literature and philosophy. Tell us how you place him.
Well, you know, Tim and Jimmy have been talking about Springsteen in the context of people like Dylan and Van Morrison. Of course, that makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I tend to think of him also in the context of, say, someone like Walt Whitman, you know, another New Jerseyan, at least at the end of his life.
Containing multitudes.
Yeah, and you know, the use of the vernacular language, and, you know, you just played Hungry Heart. I mean, there's a compression there. Actually, Whitman was not exactly short of words, but this notion of using ordinary language to speak to ordinary people in a language they can really relate to, I mean, I think that's, you know, part of the tradition that Springsteen is coming out of.
That's the literary tradition. Do you put him in a kind of philosophical vein as well?
Well, I think he's an American romantic, you know, coming out of a sort of the transcendentalist model that sort of Whitman touched on as well. And you can sort of, you know, also feed him in through the American folk tradition. I mean, obviously, Woody Guthrie is someone who's been talked about a lot. Springsteen talks about gospel music. I don't really hear a lot of gospel in Springsteen's more recent work, but spiritually anyway, I think that there's a lot of affinity there. So he's really, comes out of a democratic small d tradition, and that's, I think, what animates his work and why people get sort of excited about it.
Jimmy Gutterman, you put him kind of philosophically, politically, and certainly in performance terms in the center. I mean, he's become, despite how dark much of his music can be, how challenging much of it can be, he's very much a mainstream appeal. And you write about how when he plays, no matter who's there with him in the years of his life and performance, he becomes the center of the performance. You say he is doomed to be the center. What exactly do you mean?
I think to Jimmy,
if I may, Jim.
I think that he has created a center. He has created a world that people from all sides can become part of. He can be considered cool by, Lou Reed and Ramones on one side, and yet fit into USA for Africa singing We Are the World on the other. He has positioned himself where he wants mainstream rock and roll to be at a time when mainstream pop is a very, very bland thing. And so what we call him mainstream is in fact a little bit, wilder than what, a Lionel Richie or a Britney Spears would be up to.
But it feels so mainstream, and I don't, in this case, mean bland by that. I mean, it seems just always to feel like it's tapping into something core.
It's intended to be universal. He's intended to speak. He tries to speak for everyone, and that's a way in which he is like Whitman, trying to contain multitudes.
And you write, Jimmy Gutterman, about how Bruce Springsteen, when he performs, even when he's not around, has left scores of musicians, big names, John Mellencamp and many others, feeling eternally chagrined because they cannot get out from behind his Mack truck, his shadow.
That is quite true. And in some ways, that's a compliment. And in some ways, that's a curse.
A curse to John Mellencamp, maybe.
Well, it also might be a curse to Bruce Springsteen, for someone who has made the topic of community so important in his work and in his public statements. I wonder how he can really have a community of performers that he can be part of, aside from the folks in the E Street Band who he's been working with since he was the scruffy guy from Freehold. Mm.
Jim Cullen, help us think about the Springsteen kind of consistent themes for a moment. His music can be so dark, and yet, as you say, it's got this huge appeal and seems to be at the center of things, democratic in a way that we ultimately find affirming. How is it that he's so simultaneously dark and affirming?
Well, one way of answering that question is to point to, the great American tradition of the blues. You know, the great paradox of the blues, of course, is that you feel better by talking about how miserable you are, the kind of cathartic effect of that. And I think that, one of the great themes in Springsteen's work, Tim has talked about gender, and that's such a big one, but this notion of isolation. Springsteen has talked over and over again about people being cut off, men alone in particular. And I think that he has really put a lot of energy and thought in his work to reaching out to these people and communicating how they feel. And I think that, there's a great tradition. I mean, even someone like Elizabeth Wurtzel, the Harvard-educated writer, who spoke so powerfully in her book Prozac Nation about how Springsteen speaks to depressed people. Springsteen himself has been clinically depressed, or so he's revealed at one point or other. So I think that's part of it, this sense that you're not alone, even so that you can talk about bad things, but there's a kind of sympathy there that people really relate to. Mm.
Behind us here, of course, Bruce Springsteen's My Father's House, speaking of dark songs from his album Nebraska, 1982. Tim Riley, talk for a minute with us about this album in particular and this song in particular.
Well, Springsteen spends an early part of his career, in the first four or five records, I'd say, being very, very angry at his father. It's one of his great early themes, and he draws a great deal of strength and energy from this anger because he conveys it as a kind of a persuasively righteous anger. We feel and share with him that the older generation has disappointed him in an essential way, and in coming to grips with that and trying to look that in the face and deal with it honestly, he gains a great deal of strength. On this album, he has a song called My Father's House, and it's really about, he told the story on stage at this period and about driving around his old neighborhood and going to look at the old house, and he tells a story about going to a shrink and saying, "Why do you think I was doing that?" And the shrink said, something bad happened there, and you're trying to go back and you're trying to make it right. You're trying to fix it. And this song really is about chasing the ghost of his father. And I like to think of it as, you know, there's that great quote from JFK where he said, you know, when you're boxing with a ghost, ghost always wins.
Mm.
What's beautiful about this record how unguarded it is. I mean, the very existence of the record is an accident. The 10 songs on Nebraska were intended as demos for the album that became Born in the USA. It was mm-hmm. when he was recording the full rock band stuff for that record. And they listened to the demos, they tried to record them, and they didn't work. And eventually they found out that this little cassette that was sitting in his back pocket going back and forth to New York every day was the record.
Was an album of its own.
And I think because of that, because this was not meant for public consumption, there is an almost overheard quality about this that really sets it apart from every other record he made, even the quieter records like Tom Joder, Devils and Dust. It's a strange, strange thing.
Where did he sit and churn out these songs?
That was a dark moment in his life. You know, and Jimmy used the word unguarded, and mm-hmm. I think that one of the important aspects of that is that this record's a turning point because it's a very spiritual record. It's a very religious record. And the very title, My Father's House, mm-hmm. I think is indicative of that.
Sure.
In Atlantic City, everything dies. That's a fact, but maybe everything dies someday comes back. You know, the album ends with Reason to Believe. I mean, there's a sense of a spiritual void there that he's peering into that's really very, very powerful.
I mean, My Father's House essentially comes, whether intentionally or not, straight out of a kind of Christian liturgical speech.
Yeah, but Reason to Believe is also full of the narrator making fun of people who believe.
Yes, yes, and bitterly.
And you can hear him as he performs it on the current tour behind Devils and Dust, where he does it, where he's singing into his harmonica mic, and it sounds like the Muddy Waters Hoochie Coochie Man version of it. It's just very nasty, very angry, and there's no sense that the narrator believes in anything.
Jim Cullen, you write in particular about Bruce Springsteen's Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are many facets to that. I'm looking here at something off the web. This is 8 interesting facts about Bruce. When he was in the 3rd grade, a nun stuffed Springsteen, an altar boy, in a trash can under her desk for misbehaving. Okay, I'm not saying that was his formative Catholic experience, but how do you see the Catholicism or that youth, that upbringing running through his work?
Boy, I tell you, he's a classic illustration of how you can take the boy out of Catholicism, but you can't take Catholicism out of the boy. You know, Springsteen, as has been indicated, you know, in some ways had a very hostile relationship to the Catholic Church. A good example of that is a 1973 song where he asks a priest where he can find a whore, and the priest gives him detailed directions.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that, you know, that sort of bitterness and that anger manifesting itself on those first couple of records. But at the same time, you can also see these unselfconscious or perhaps unwitting metaphors, crosses and characters named Mary and so on, you know, as early as Born to Run. And more recent records, I think, Springsteen is much more straightforward and willing to grapple with his Catholic heritage. But it's a very ecumenical approach. I mean, I think the Rising is interesting in that regard. I mean, you have a song like Mary's Place that makes references to Buddha, and there are songs about, you know, Islam and so on. So I think he's a very interesting figure at this time. You want to talk about a center. You know, here's someone who has a sense of spirituality, a spiritualism that comes from the music, among other things, but who has a broad vision and who does not, you know, speak in relatively narrow terms, and yet seems to me, from where I sit, you know, reasonably comfortable with his faith. I mean, I think a song like, you know, Jesus Was an Only Son from the new record is one of the most profound and beautiful expressions of the ineffable mystery of life that I've heard in popular music in quite some time.
And for those who haven't heard the new album, what's the message of Jesus Was an Only Son?
Well, I think the message is the limits of human knowledge, you know, that you know, that here's Jesus on the cross talking to his mother Mary and saying, you know, we don't really understand this, but we don't understand how God made a world with so much beauty either. And, you know, this willingness, I think one of the things that makes Springsteen a very attractive artist is this sense of limits, all kinds of limits. I mean, you know, even in terms of what was talked about earlier, in terms of his masculinity. I mean, there's not an imperial self. And of course, rock and roll, you know, from Elvis Presley down through Mick Jagger, you know, and beyond, even to someone like Eminem, is all about, you know, the imperial self. And I think that there's a becoming modesty about Springsteen that makes him a very, very compelling figure in this context.
I want to look at that notion and what Jim Gutterman calls the two Bruces, but we've got a Madison Square Garden full of listeners who want to join this conversation. I want to begin to turn to them. Tom is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Tom. You're on the air. How does Bruce Springsteen fit into your life?
Hi. Great conversation, first of all. How does he fit into my life? Well, I've seen him 160 times.
160 times in person?
Testify.
Wow.
I'm going 161 in Buffalo shortly and 162 after that. However, and to be honest here, I'm sitting with my girlfriend who's a nurse in surgery at Buffalo General, and she thinks I have a broken hip and I can barely walk. But the thing is, if I go to the hospital and they diagnose me with such, I'll miss the shows.
Oh, Tom, get a grip, my friend. What takes you back? Why 161 times?
I don't know. As I told your screener, Springsteen's somebody you can grow up with, as opposed to other major stature acts like the Stones or anybody else. They kind of one-trick ponies. They stay the same, whereas Springsteen has evolved lyrically, if not musically, as was discussed about his transformation back from jazz to more conservative. But a lot of it is, I think, somebody mentioned the word misfit. And he truly is every man. He's that misfit who makes it but doesn't really want to make it. You know, everything in his songs, Reason to Believe, everything, there's this outlying hope. Nobody seems to get the reward in the end, but there's always the hope, and the hope in itself is the reward.
Tom, we can hear that you've been there. Don't forget to take care of that hip. I think Bruce would want you to, if I may advise you. But wow, what a Stone fan. Thank you for calling. There's a lot in what Tom has to say here to dig into. I hardly know where to start. But maybe let's start with this idea of Springsteen as the misfit. This might be a moment, Jimmy, to go back to what Stephen Metcalf is writing, which is very interesting. In his book, part of this big wave, calls Springsteen, he says, look, this was the scrawny little dirtbag from the shore. And he says it kind of sympathetically, not that there's anything wrong with that, who was turned by John Landau, the Rolling Stone critic, who once said famously, I've seen rock and roll's future and its name is Bruce Springsteen. And he got next to Bruce Springsteen and said, Bruce, let me tell you how to become great. Let me tell you how to become the great American rock and roller. And you'll do it by adopting this persona, a persona that he calls the majestic American simpleton.
Yeah, Metcalf's problem is that the facts get in the way of his theory. Everyone who is close to other people have an effect. If I have a close friend, if I have a wife, if I have a child, someone who's close to me, they're going to have an effect on what I read, on what I listen to, on what I do.
But Metcalf says it's not just an effect. It's a deliberate persona that he turns Springsteen into the equivalent of a white minstrel act, pretending to be the everyman, the working man.
Well, then how could Springsteen have been a talented person to start with if he made this what Metcalf seems to say is a Faustian deal? I mean, Springsteen's made some not great records, but it hasn't been a result of his body being taken over by another person. You know, we're talking about Bruce and the enormous effect that he's had on his fans, the fellow who mm-hmm. just called. You know, people are going to call. They're going to testify. Mm-hmm. But, you know, let us not forget that another big part of it is the fact that when you go to these concerts in particular, he doesn't have that much fun on his records anymore, but the concerts are enormously enjoyable. They're a lot of fun. He's just as capable of putting, you know, the best mindless rock and roll song you've ever heard, as well as the most thoughtful.
And more consistently great in performance, you write, Jim Gutterman, than any other rock and roller, as you put it, in history.
That's true. I mean, you will peel the Rolling Stone at Fenway's tickets out of my cold, dead hands, but it's not because I want to go see them perform their new songs.
But, I mean, you say Dylan has plenty of off nights. So does everybody else. But when it's Bruce Springsteen, particularly with the E Street Band, right, they are going to cough it up for you. They're going to deliver.
Indeed, and I think it's part of the work ethic that he has written about so many times, particularly on the Darkness on the Edge of Town record from 1978. It's work. They take it very seriously. But you know what? It's not just work. They do call it playing. We're going to play tonight. I'm going to see the band play.
Jim Cullen, we just got the 30 seconds before the break. Where do you expect to see Bruce Springsteen go? He's only 55. Where does he go? Where does he evolve to?
Well, I think that, you know, we talked about the model that he made for himself and the way that he, you know, perhaps simplified his work. And I think that some of these folks have written about the different versions of Springsteen. I think he'll alternate. I think that, you know, he'll be part of the band. He'll be the priest performing the religious ritual on stage. And then he'll also be the prophet, you know, who makes records like Devils and Dust. I mean, I think he has a potential longevity that very few people in popular music have ever attained.
A lot of people hoping so. Jim Cullen, author of Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen and the American Tradition, thank you for joining us from New York tonight.
Thanks very much.
We'll go out with Philadelphia. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh, brother, gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the new wave of interpretations of Bruce Springsteen, rocker, poet, American troubadour. Here he is from his 2002 album with The Rising.
Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind. Make my way through this darkness. I can't feel nothing but this chain that binds me. Lost track of how far I've gone. How far I've gone, how high I've climbed. On my back's a 60-pound stone. On my shoulder, half mile of line. Come on up for the rising. Come on up, lay your hands in mine. Come on.
You can join our conversation tonight. What's your greatest Springsteen moment, memory, concert, with lyrics that are often so dark? How is Springsteen still seen as so affirming? And what is the America Bruce Springsteen stands for, sings to? Did Bruce Springsteen thrill you when he toured for John Kerry, or did he betray you? And what is the heart of Bruce Springsteen's appeal? We're joined tonight by Jimmy Gutterman. His new book, and it's a wonderful book, is Runaway American Dream, Listening to Bruce Springsteen. Tim Riley's with us as well, rock critic, author of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Pat is calling right now from Grants Pass, Oregon. Pat, great to have you. What do you say?
Hi. He raised my kids.
He raised your kids? Tell us how.
He did a wonderful job. One, David is a car designer, owns his own firm in Germany. John is with Gilead, a pharmaceutical rep, and been International AIDS Conference.
And how did Bruce put them there, the boss?
You hit it when you said, in adolescence, there is a yearning. And you were asking, how does he say such hard things and yet make it come out positive?
Yeah.
Now, there are, in each of us, archetypes, innate releasing mechanisms. Mm. He may say things that are hard, but the vibration of his music in the end is, I can do it. It is so positive. They'd have it on in their rooms. They picked it up. I wasn't dumb enough, Mom, to try.
but there it was, and it raised them. You give Bruce credit for getting them on the right track through the hard stuff.
I do. He hit the archetype. He hits that. And it's not only in his word, driving around his father's house, or that all adolescents are yearning for something. They have an established self.
And Bruce lets them set it free, you say, in a way that worked for your kids. Pat, thanks very much for your call. Let's hear more voices here. Allegra is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Allegra, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I was just going to say, I see him almost like a journalist. He's a really good storyteller, and what I had read about after 9/11 was that, and he's rarely interviewed, he rarely gets interviews, but he said how he did The Rising when he would read the New York Times every day with the victims' profiles that they ran for
hundreds upon hundreds.
He would actually call the victims' families and interview them, he said, and he like did reporting, and then he wove their lives into his story, which are his songs. So I think that was really, I feel like he did that with so much thought and feeling and care. It was the way that I would do things as a journalist, and it just felt like real community journalism, you know what I mean?
Yes, I do, exactly. And it's a wonderful observation, Allegra.
Yeah.
Thanks for making it. Thanks for joining us. Jimmy Gutterman, how about it? Bruce Springsteen as explorer of his own internal demons and joys, and as a kind of observer, journalist, feedback.
Well, he's a reflection. He's a mirror. I mean, the reason that he gets 50,000 people to go see him in a stadium is because he creates this feeling, this sense, this artifice, if you want to look at it that way, that he is a reflection of the his life is a reflection of that of the people in the crowd. Obviously, his life is probably dramatically different from that of the folks in the crowd. But what's so interesting about him, and I think what is crucial to his longevity and popularity as a performer, is that even though he has become so successful commercially, critically, people still feel he's one of them.
You write about the two Bruces. Remind us what you mean by that.
Well, there's, I guess, the artist Bruce and the rocker Bruce. There's the Bruce who is quite comfortable to sit in his living room and sit on his rocking chair and record the songs that turned out to be Nebraska and can be very, very satisfied by that. But then there's the guy who needs to be out there every night. You know, I grew up in New Jersey, so I was there for it. You know, the summers of 82, 83, it seemed like every night he was up there with some mediocre bar band down the shore. If you were in a band in New Jersey in the early 80s and Springsteen didn't go on stage with you, there was something really, really wrong with you. And I think that he has these sort of two competing impulses, and you hear that in his records as well, that he will have the big, loud, broad statements like A Rising or like A Born in the USA,
yeah,
and often follow them up with something more insular like a Tunnel of Love or Devils and Dust.
The poet, the rocker. Jay's calling from Boston. Jay, what do you say?
I say that, you know, I feel fortunate. I saw Bruce Springsteen in 72 or 73 when I was in college at Georgetown University in a really small venue, and you know what I appreciated most about Bruce was his stage performance, his energy level, and the fact that he paid homage to all the rock and roll greats, you know, from Elvis to James Brown to Buddy Holly, you name it, Sam Cooke. I mean, it was great to go to the shows way back then, when he did four-hour shows and took it into
Maine. And now, Jay, when he's more lately, Devils and Dust, very quiet, the other Bruce, as Jimmy Gutterman would have it, here's Jesus Was an Only Son we talked about earlier. Does it grab you in the same way, or are you just up for the rocker, Bruce?
Well, you know, I like the performance. As I said, you know, I mean, I saw him one night, and he went from in the middle of Back Streets. He did a little thing called I'd Drive All Night Again, you know, just to buy you a pair of shoes, and that turned out to be a song on another album, you know, and it's the spontaneity and the encores and the you know, the old rock and roll songs he would do, and I saw him in Providence one time, and his Stevie Van Zandt broke a guitar string, and he was tuning it, and Bruce came out solo and did Elvis Presley, Love Me Tender, you know, I mean...
That's pretty great, but you're only going to get that in performance. Jay, thank you so much for calling. Tim Riley, there's the gentle Bruce behind us, religious, as Jim Cullen was saying earlier, and then there's the great rocker. How do you stack them up against each other, or do we need to?
Well, I think this is really the dilemma that Springsteen faces in the late phase of his career. We're well into the third act of his career now, and I think the big problem he has on his records, the unevenness that's been a problem with the records he's released since 1992, is that the production element really has been lacking. He's not very... He has a certain ambivalence about John Landau, who was his manager and early rock critic, very important rock critic, who produced a lot of early records. He's a really wonderful producer. But Springsteen feels now as though he wants to produce himself, and he wants to move on and have other people produce him. And so he's hired Brendan O'Brien, who worked with Pearl Jam, to do the production on his last two records. And I think the production's really uneven. And I think that's a key problem for Bruce Springsteen. And it's part of framing the sensibility that Jimmy just drew out, these two different sides of Bruce.
Jimmy Gutterman, we just got about a minute left here. You describe how Bruce Springsteen ends so many concerts recently, saying, I can't promise you eternal life. Springsteen would shout almost every night on the reunion tour, you write, but I can promise you life right now. That's something to deliver, and he does from the stage.
That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about in life, and that's why the performances are what he's going to be remembered for. More than anything else, he's made some wonderful records, but it's really on stage that he's done something that I hope it's not ineffable, because I wrote a book trying to describe it, but that's where the, for lack of a better term, the magic happens.
He also says repeatedly, remember, the country we care in our hearts is waiting. He's such an American performer. What is that country to Bruce at Springsteen's mind? The country that's waiting in our hearts.
Well, I think that's who he's been his whole career, and that's why he finally became a very vocal partisan in the 04 election. He had been up for various causes in the past, but this was the first time he said, something really bad is happening out there, and let's change it.
He stood up, standing a little more quiet right now. It's been great talking with both of you tonight. Jimmy Gutterman, author of the new book, Runaway American Dream, listening to Bruce Springsteen. Terrific book. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having us.
And Tim Riley, always good to see you. Author of Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America. Wonderful to have you here, Tim.
Thank you, Tom.
Behind us, sorry folks, I go way back, my personal favorite. Just let me dance with Bruce. It's Rosalita from The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a long-time London resident reflects on the tragedy that struck his city. This is On Point. The death toll from yesterday's terrorist attacks in London has risen to at least 50. That number is expected to climb even higher, as police say. More bodies remain to be recovered from subway cars deep underground. It has been an emotional week in London. It started on a high note with the awarding of the 2012 Olympic Games. It ended with terror and tragedy. Tonight, British novelist Ian McEwan reflects on the week that was in his home city, London.
The mood of a city has never swung so sharply. On Wednesday, there was no better place on earth. After the victory in Singapore, Londoners were celebrating the prospect of an explosion of new energy and creativity. Those computer-generated images of futuristic wonderlands rising out of derelict quarters and poisoned industrial wastelands were actually going to be built. The echoes of rock and roll in Hyde Park and its wave of warm and fundamentally decent emotions were only just fading. In Glen Eagles, the summit was about to address, at least, and at last, the core of the world's concerns, and we could take some satisfaction that our government had pushed the agenda. London was flying high, and we moved confidently about the city. The paranoia after 9/11 and Madrid was mostly forgotten, and no one had second thoughts about taking the tube. The war on terror, that much-examined trope, was an exhausted rallying cry, with all the appearances of a moth-eaten regimental banner in a village church. But terror's war on us opened another front on Thursday morning. It announced itself with a howl of sirens from every quarter and the oppressive drone of police helicopters. Along the Euston Road by the new University College Hospital, a green building rising above us like a giant surgeon in scrubs, thousands of people stood around watching ambulances filing nose to tail through the stalled traffic into the casualty department. Police were fanning out through Bloomsbury, closing streets at both ends, even as you were halfway down them. The machinery of state, a great leviathan, certain of its authority, moved with balletic coordination. Those rehearsals for a multiple terrorist attack underground were paying off. In fact, now the disaster was upon us, it had an air of weary inevitability, and it looked familiar, as though it had happened long ago. In the drizzle and dim light, the police lines, the emergency vehicles, the silent passers-by appeared as though in an old newsreel film, in black and white. The news of the successful Olympic bid was more surprising than this. How could we have forgotten that this was always going to happen? The mood on the streets was of numb acceptance or strange calm. People obediently shuffled this way and that, directed round roadblocks by a whole new citizens' army of support officials, like air raid wardens from the last war. A man in a suit pulled a day-glow jacket out of his briefcase and began directing traffic with snappy expertise. A woman with blood covering her face and neck, who had come from Russell Square tube station, briskly refused offers of help and said she had to get to work. Groups gathered impassively in the road among the gridlocked traffic, listening through open windows to car radios. On a pub TV, the breaking news services were having trouble finding the images to match the awfulness of the event. But this was not, or not yet, a public spectacle like New York or Madrid. The nightmare was happening far below our feet. Everyone knew that if the force that mangled the bus in Tavistock Square was contained within the walls of a tunnel, the human cost would be high and the rescue appallingly difficult. Down the far end of a closed-off street, we saw emergency workers being helped into breathing equipment. We could only guess at the hell to which they must descend, and no one seemed to want to talk about it. In Auden's famous poem, Musée des Beaux-Arts, the tragedy of Icarus falling from the sky is accompanied by life simply refusing to be disrupted. A plowman goes about his work, a ship sailed calmly on, dogs keep on with their doggy business. In London yesterday, where crowds fumbling with cell phones tried to find unimpeded ways across the city, there was much evidence of the truth of Auden's insight. While rescue workers searched for survivors and the dead in a smoke-filled blackness below, at pavement level, men were loading office furniture into lorries. A woman sold umbrellas in her usual patch. The lunchtime sandwich makers were hard at work. It is unlikely that London will claim to have been transformed in an instant, to have lost its innocence in the course of a morning. It is hard to knock a huge city like this off its course. It has survived many attacks in the past. But once we have counted up our dead and the numbness turns to anger and grief, we will see that our lives here will be difficult. We have been savagely woken from a pleasant dream. The city will not recover Wednesday's confidence and joy in a very long time. Who will want to travel on the tube once it has been cleared? How will we sit at our ease in a restaurant, cinema, or theater? And we will face again that deal we must constantly make and remake with the state. How much power must we grant Leviathan? How much freedom will we be asked to trade for our security?
British author Ian McEwan's latest novel is titled Saturday. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.